Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and very pleased to have Rebecca Roop joining us today. Rebecca has written more than a dozen books for children and adults, including Weather, which we offered on this program as a pledge premium earlier this year. She holds a PhD in cell biology and biochemistry and has written hundreds of articles for magazines, including Early American Life, Mother Earth News, Natural History, Green Prince, and the Utney Reader. Her most recent book is How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. Rebecca lives in Vermont and joins us from there by phone. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Judith.
Well, it's a really fun book. I just have to tell you that.
I'm so glad you liked it.
And I can tell that you had fun writing it, I think.
I had a blast writing it.
Well, I think we should start with the obvious question, which whenever I tell someone I'm reading the book, their first question is, well, how did carrots win the Trojan War? So why don't we start there?
I think carrots won the Trojan War very peripherally, but you've got to admit it's a great title.
It's a great title.
The story is that when Ulysses or Odysseus packed his soldiers into the Trojan horse. They were going to be in the horse for a good long time. So to avoid bathroom breaks, they munched carrots, which reputedly bound their bowels, so they could wait overnight, get dragged into the city, and conquer the Trojans.
So
I know it's a little far-fetched, but
we were speculating that had they not been able to control themselves by means of carrots, that perhaps their morale would have been lower and they wouldn't have been successful. And maybe that's how carrots really won the Trojan War.
Absolutely. Maybe they prevented infighting.
There you go. Yeah, because it could have gotten pretty uncomfortable there in the Trojan horse. Well, you go through the history and mythology of a lot of common garden veggies. One thing that they all seem to have in common is that they were believed to have potent medicinal uses or effects on the body. For being considered a pretty bland vegetable, usually, celery is one that was really given some pretty potent associations. Why don't you tell us about celery?
Oh, celery. You know what fascinated me was to discover that celery had been associated with death.
Hmm.
There was a Greek saying, now he has need of nothing but celery, which meant, there was nothing more they could do for you. You were about to, shuffle off the mm-hmm. mortal coil. Wreaths of celery, decorated tombs. In fact, in Tutankhamun's tomb, they found a withered wreath of celery leaves.
And why was there that association with death?
I am not clear. Apparently it struck someone as an appropriately dismal herb. Celery used to be a really upbeat veggie. It was expensive to grow because it was blanched. So it had to be hand buried and hand cut. And so it was in the Gilded Age, in the late 1800s, it was Lady Astor would have had it on her table.
And it was white celery that was especially desirable.
Absolutely. And it was served not in these little flat dishes like everybody's grandma serves celery at Thanksgiving, but in these tall urn-like vases that were very elaborate and expensive, these big silver things where your celery stuck up so everybody could see that you had celery.
So it was really a centerpiece of the table.
Absolutely. If you had celery, you wanted to flaunt that celery.
So when was it that celery became that more common vegetable?
Well, a self-blanching variety of celery was developed, which made celery much, much easier to grow and maintain. And once celery started to be within the reach of the common people, it kind of dwindled to the flat dish and the common munchie.
And what other qualities were attributed to celery?
Celery. It had a raft of all vegetables were said to have a raft of pharmaceutical powers and whatnot. Celery, in particular, was said to be a real sex booster. The story went that Casanova routinely ate celery before his nights on the town. And actually, interestingly enough, some recent research says that this might be absolutely true. analysis show that celery actually contains a natural steroid that's otherwise found in human sweat and in boar saliva. And apparently women love this.
So it's a pheromone.
So it's a pheromone. So, you know, maybe munching a bit of celery before a blind date is the way to go for men.
Well, and you also talk about the kind of diet myth that celery is so full of water and so tough to chew that it's actually negative calories, but that's not really true.
Oh, that's not true. I was so crushed to discover this because, you know, I'd floated on this one for years, you know.
Right.
But no, it's not true, and neither is the related myth that drinking cold beer has negative calories because you have to use a lot of body energy to warm the beer up once it hits your digestive tract.
That one seems a little more far-fetched than the celery, I have to say.
Yeah, but they're so nice, and no.
Nope. Well, it's good to keep in mind as we might be trying to stick to various New Year's resolutions that there are no quick fixes. Well, we are talking with Rebecca Roop. She has written more than a dozen books for both adults and children. And her most recent book is How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. Do you wonder what the story is behind your favorite vegetable? Did you grow up with ideas or beliefs about certain garden veggies? Or maybe you've heard a tale that you'd like to share with Rebecca. You can do so by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer today, she will get your calls and emails to us. So conversely, Rebecca, potatoes are so ubiquitous now, but they were really a hard sell in the beginning. First of all, where did potatoes or tubers related to potatoes originate?
They're South American originally. And there's always been a lot of confusion in a lot of early vegetables because things certainly that were picked up by early explorers and transported to Europe, people weren't always sure exactly where they came from. For example, potatoes early on were always known as Virginia potatoes. But the story goes that actually the potatoes introduced into Ireland and England came from Sir Francis Drake, who, after picking off a few Spaniards in the Caribbean, got a shipload of potatoes in Colombia, then paused in Virginia to collect the Roanoke colonists, who many of whom were willing to go home by the time he arrived. And so the Virginia potatoes actually were Colombian potatoes that paused briefly in Virginia. Then, apparently, Drake passed some of the potatoes on to Sir Walter Raleigh, who grew them on his estate and made a present of them to Queen Elizabeth, which was a huge mistake because nobody knew how to cook potatoes,
right.
And potatoes were funny looking.
Well, sure, if you'd never seen one before, you certainly wouldn't look at that big, bulbous, dirty thing and think, that looks like a great dinner.
Though, frankly, nothing like a Hubbard squash. I can't imagine anybody had the guts to eat a Hubbard squash. But so instead of cooking the potatoes, they cooked the stems, leaves, and greenery that came with the potatoes.
With disastrous results.
With disastrous results, because these things contained mildly poisonous alkaloids, which made everybody feel horrible.
Are they worse when they're cooked, also?
I don't think they're worse when they're cooked.
They're just bad.
They're not good. On the other hand, so many people protested potatoes. There was actually an 18th century journalist who just frothed at the mouth over potatoes, said they were morally degenerate. This vegetable is a disaster, and he only wished that Sir Walter Raleigh had been beheaded earlier before he had a chance to introduce potatoes to the British.
Well, and it's kind of funny because potatoes seemed to inspire royal edicts to grow them and a very strong opposition from various groups of peasants, whether it was Russian or Prussian. And there was a great passage in History magazine, and you reference this in the book, but I'd like to just read this because it's so entertaining and such an interesting psychological experiment. Frederick the Great of Prussia saw the potato's potential to help feed his nation and lower the price of bread, but faced the challenge of overcoming the people's prejudice against the plant. When he issued a 1774 order for his subjects to grow potatoes as protection against famine, the town of Kolmberg replied, "The things have neither smell nor taste, nor not even the dogs will eat them. So what use are they to us?" Trying a less direct approach to encourage his subjects to begin planting potatoes, Frederick used a bit of reverse psychology. He planted a royal field of potato plants and stationed a heavy guard to protect the field from thieves. Nearby peasants naturally assumed that anything worth guarding was worth stealing, and so snuck into the field and snatched the plants for their home gardens. Of course, this was entirely in line with Frederick's wishes.
I love it. There's multiple stories about Frederick. One is much less nice that says that he issued an edict saying everybody plant potatoes or have your ears and noses cut off. And the other one is that he appeared on the balcony of the royal palace and ate a potato publicly, and that just inspired everybody to go out and do likewise.
Well, potatoes, you know, we do associate potatoes with Ireland and, of course, the Irish potato famine. What were the conditions that led to that real tragedy that changed the history of Ireland forever and also really changed the history of the United States because so many Irish came here?
Oh, the Irish potato famine was a tremendous tragedy. I mean, there's just no coping with that one. The Irish at the time were living almost solely on potatoes and almost solely on one basic variety of potato that was called the lumper.
Very descriptive.
Imagine, oh, absolutely. Actually all potatoes are kind of lumpers. But this was a big, mealy, nutritious potato, and you could, easily feed a family of five or six for a year off of an acre of potatoes. So the Irish, nourished on potatoes, had a population boom. Things were going nicely until the blight hit. And this was very sudden. People went out to the potato harvest in the early 1840s, dug up the potatoes, and the things had turned to black slime in the ground.
And so the plants above ground were still growing, so they had no indication that this crop that they relied so heavily on was completely wiped out.
It's a vicious, it's actually the blight is caused by a fungus, a water mold, and the spores wash into the soil and wipe out the growing potatoes. It's still a problem, but it's not as much of a problem because potatoes now are much more diversified. Mm-hmm. There are more resistant strains of potatoes. But the mold in question, whose scientific name means plant destroyer, is so vicious. People have actually discussed, certain governments have discussed using it as a biological warfare weapon.
Hmm. Does it affect only potatoes, or are there other crops that are potentially affected?
There are other, it'll hit tomatoes, other potato relatives, so presumably peppers, mm-hmm. eggplant. But, of course, potatoes are much more of a major field crop.
Right.
A big food source for a lot of people.
We are talking with author Rebecca Roop, who has written more than a dozen books for children and adults, including the fascinating and fun How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. Do you have a favorite vegetable that you'd like to hear the backstory on? Or maybe you have a story or a tale that you've been told that you'd like to share with Rebecca. We'd love to have you join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a comment or question or a veggie photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. And Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. talking about the wonderful world of veggies with author Rebecca Roop, author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. And Rebecca, right before the break, we were talking about potatoes and other related vegetables, including tomatoes, eggplants, peppers. They all belong to the nightshade family. And there are a lot of folk beliefs around nightshades. What are some of them and how true are they?
Some of them are true and some of them are not quite so true. For example, the eggplant, from its relationship to truly nasty things like deadly nightshade and mandrake, was called the mad apple or the raging apple, from a belief that eating one would immediately drive you insane. And it took a while and some brave Italian cooks before Europe got over fear of eggplant. Certainly the Middle East was had survived that neatly because they're like a hotbed of eggplant cookery. It's not good to be related to a nightshade.
And what is the whole, there is a lot of mythology around nightshades. What are they thought to do? You mentioned the mandrake, which it's said that when mandrake roots are pulled, they scream like babies.
Right, and we all remember this from Harry Potter.
Right, exactly.
But they do have an odd kind of witchy humanoid root, which I'm sure was the beginning of that legend.
They look like a human, well, let's see, they look like a sweet potato kind of in the shape of a human.
Right.
So it is kind of creepy looking.
Yeah, a pudgy, creepy human.
And a lot of those early beliefs about vegetables and fruits, too, I'm sure, there was a lot of assumptions made based on their shape or their color and associations, like, you know, things that were, say, dark red were associated with blood, or like you said, you know, things that had a slightly human shape, you know, were considered to be kind of some kind of odd vegetable hybrid. I mean, a lot of it was based on physical appearance, right?
Sure. This really is the medieval doctrine of signatures that said, you know, this is God's hint to tell you what this plant is for. So a kidney-shaped kidney bean was thought to deal with ailments of the urinary tract. And a walnut, which is wrinkly and looks kind of like a brain, was thought to be good for diseases of the head or head wounds. But you know what I think is fascinating about a lot of the very early vegetables is why we ever considered putting them in our mouths in the first place. You know, early on, so many vegetables were either tiny or hard or bitter or spiny or prickly or even slightly poisonous. And there were a bunch of brave hunter-gatherers who were out there experimenting with this stuff.
Well, for instance, corn in its original form was not very palatable.
Not at all. And some of the earliest corn finds from, 9,000-year-old archaeological digs are these teensy little corn cobs the size of pencil erasers. And you think, why bother?
Right, right. Now, you said corn was, there's evidence of it 9,000 years ago. Is that one of the earliest that we have proof of use, and what about domestication?
There are, domestication, of course, is always tricky because, you know, you can go to the earliest you've got, and you don't know that that's, you know, the signal for domestication. And some vegetables are so old, like lentils. These go back to the earliest beginnings of agriculture, 10,000 years ago.
And we do have some callers, Rebecca, who would like to join the conversation. So let's go to Robert in Mauston first. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was wondering if Rebecca ever heard about the English. You know, the English have always had a fine regard for the Irish. So when the first boatload of potatoes showed up at Ireland, the English EPA showed up and inspected the cargo. And they thought, uh-oh, this is not a good situation. If the Irish start eating all these potatoes and then they have a fungus come in, and they'll have a big famine and maybe a million Irish will die. So the English were about to turn this boat back when the Irish had what's called a reverse Boston Tea Party. They went on this ship and instead of throwing the potatoes in the ocean, they threw them on shore, and that's when the Irish start eating all these potatoes, and they had that unfortunate famine.
Well, I hadn't heard that, but That's interesting.
Well, and yeah, it's kind of it's almost similar to that Prussia story where, you know, the more something is banned or considered only for some people, the more the rest of the people want it.
Well, there was a lot of encouragement for peasants, the poor, the workers to eat potatoes because they were cheap, they were available, and in a sense, they fueled the Industrial Revolution. All of a sudden, you had a lot of easy food.
All right, and we also have Betty in Madison with a potato-related question. Let's go there. Hi, Betty.
Hi. I'm sorry, we're going back to the potato issue.
Oh, no problem.
One of the things that I had heard was that, yes, the potato famine was really an issue for Irish migration, but also that Cromwell, and I don't know the date, had beef. And Cromwell had decided that Ireland should grow this beef for them, and prior to that, it had been agricultural, and the serfs were there, I don't know if they were called serfs back then, to farm the land. And at that point, they no longer needed the number of people that they had in the land. So England put a tax on the landed gentry according to the number of serfs they had, and so that it became more economical in some cases for the landowners to pay passage for the serfs to America or wherever because of the tax, and that this also accounted for the migration. And this is what I've heard. I don't know a lot about it.
How does that sound to you, Rebecca?
Cromwell would have been in the mid-1600s, and his move through Ireland was absolutely devastating when he conquered the Irish and starved a lot of people to death. But I've understood that the laws that were passed under Cromwell actually bound the Irish to the land. I mean, that's when the Irish became serfs of English landlords.
And is that what your understanding was, Betty?
Not exactly, okay. But it sounded like at some point, and maybe he started it, but at some point it became where they did not really want the number of serfs and wanted beef cattle instead.
Well, and it's interesting, it's a little off to the side on that issue, but Rebecca, their vegetables were really considered inferior nourishment compared to meats.
Oh, for a long time. And especially, you know, in Britain, you know, beef was the meal for a decent Englishman. And herbs and roots were just for the lowest of the low.
Well, and a menu might have five different courses, and they might include eight different meats.
Yes, meat, and more meat.
Exactly.
And dessert.
And dessert, which might be meat, too. Lisa in Rhinelander is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard another author on NPR talking about a year ago about a book he wrote, and I wasn't listening all that closely until he mentioned, so I don't have his name, unfortunately, but he mentioned the children born during the Irish potato famine had a high incidence of schizophrenia. Although, you know, at that time we probably didn't diagnose it as schizophrenia, but he said that it gave rise to the unfortunate stereotype of the crazy Irish in this country.
And did he say what it was that they were eating when they didn't have potatoes that might have caused it?
No, I don't recall him saying that, but it gave rise to a study in Canada relating B vitamins and schizophrenia. And they gave a high number, I think it was like in the hundreds of patients who had schizophrenia, high levels of B vitamins over the course of a year, and after a year, they were all cured.
That's absolutely fascinating. You know, the only thing I know about, you know, I know, for example, niacin deprivation will give you pellagra.
And explain pellagra?
Pellagra is a dietary deficiency disease caused by a diet that's very, very heavy in corn, which isn't a complete protein. It's missing a couple of amino acids, and it's missing niacin, which is vitamin B3. And when corn was first introduced to Europe, maize, American corn, people began to develop this disease. They were sometimes called the butterfly people because it first appeared as a rash across their cheeks and nose that just spread, created these scabby, swollen skin lesions all over their bodies. And it was a deficiency disease from eating improperly prepared too much corn.
Mm.
And there was a study that was done some years ago that proposed that corn and pellagra might have been the root of the European vampire legends, because some of the symptoms of pellagra are kind of vampiric, not the bite your neck and suck blood symptom, but the people became light sensitive. It developed into a wasting disease, so people became pale and skinny.
Hmm.
And it was associated eventually with a dementia. So corn might just have made Dracula.
Dracula?
Yeah.
We are talking with author Rebecca Roop, who's written more than a dozen books for children and adults, including her most recent, How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables. If you have a question or comment, please join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And Sue wrote on Facebook, "My favorite vegetable is Swiss chard. What can Rebecca tell us about this vegetable?"
Oh, Swiss chard. Beets. It looks like the earliest beets grown were actually chard, leaf beets, that were grown specifically to be eaten kind of like spinach.
So what we think of a beets is when they're grown to create that large bulb, but different varieties are grown more for what goes on above ground instead of below ground, and so the chards are part of that group.
Yep, they're leaf beets. The Romans, they believe the Romans developed the below ground, the red root beet. And initially those were thought of as good for medicine, but not necessarily for eating. So the chards ruled the roost for a good long time. There's one story that chard was sacred to Apollo, and I found one reference that said that the Greeks referred to the leaf beets as tutelion, which is a word related to squid tentacles, because supposedly they thought they resembled squid tentacles. I don't see this, but I thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that comment, Sue. So you have a chapter on several different varieties of vegetables. The chapter on peas is titled "In Which Peas Almost Poisoned General Washington." What's the story behind that?
Oh, when they did. The story is that during the Revolutionary War, when Washington was in New York, 1776, he went to have a meal with his compatriots at the Francis Tavern, and a loyalist, definitely opposed to the revolution, named Thomas Hickey, decided to do Washington in by poisoning his dish of peas. But luckily, the tavern owner's young daughter, Phoebe, discovered the plot and intercepted the peas before they got all the way to the general.
So it wasn't actually the peas themselves. It was the poison that had been added to the peas.
It was the poison in the peas, yes. It wasn't the fault of the peas. But Thomas was apprehended and was hanged before a crowd of 20,000 cheering revolutionaries. So he came to a bad end.
And tell us more about peas, because that's one of the vegetables that has really been developed very intentionally to be much more palatable and more delicious for human consumption.
Yeah, apparently the early pea was a very high starch, tough, chewy pea, so that the story of the princess and the pea might have had some truth to it. You might just have been able to feel this pea through your mattress. And it was made into peas porridge, of course, for centuries.
Peas porridge hot, peas porridge cold?
Yeah, right. 9 days old might have been more like it. But then in the 18th century, a guy named Thomas Knight, who was a hobby horticulturist, he'd been raised on an estate where he was always fascinated with gardening. And he'd watch the gardeners. In fact, as a little boy, there's a story that he was convinced that anything you buried would grow. So he planted his pocket knife in hopes of getting a pocket knife tree.
Was not successful.
It was not successful, but it didn't really deter him. And as an adult, he inherited a castle and a fortune and spent the rest of his life immersed in horticulture. And he developed, serendipitously, he discovered this wrinkle-seeded pea that was just a scrumptious, tender, sugar-heavy, yummy pea. They were called marrowfat peas. And that was really the beginning of peas becoming immensely popular because suddenly they were delicious.
And you
actually, Thomas Knight is kind of a frustrating story because when you read his work, he did all the same experiments that Gregor Mendel mm-hmm. did with crossing peas that led to the laws of Mendelian genetics. But Knight just never quite made the jump. You know, he had all the data were there, but he never took the next step to inheritance.
And to kind of synthesize all that for what it means for genetics.
No, but he made some great peas.
And we're thankful for that.
Absolutely. And after that, peas really began to take off.
Well, we have Connie and Madison on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Connie.
Hi. Some cultures very much like a more bitter flavor in some of their vegetables, and I'm thinking of the difference between American broccoli and Italian broccoli rabe, they call it, R-A-B-E, which is a much smaller flower and a much more bitter flavor, which is really considered quite the delicacy and quite the desirable side dish for Italians. Can you describe other variants where a vegetable is maybe bred to be sort of sweeter or more bland in large distribution, but in ethnic societies there might be a more bitter version that's valued?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily always a bitter version, but there's a lot of examples of ethnic preferences. I was thinking, for example, of kohlrabi or stem cabbage, mm-hmm. which really is very unpopular in the United States, but is much loved in Germany, for example. Or asparagus, tastes in asparagus. We much prefer green asparagus, but the primo asparagus in Germany is white asparagus, which, you know, to me looks odd. It's interesting. The taste is different. It's kind of a slightly butterier asparagus, but it's clearly an ethnic preference.
And thanks for that call, Connie. I also actually thought about peppers and, you know, how many of the mass-produced peppers are sweet bell peppers or some variety like that. But there are certainly a lot of peppers that are grown to be as hot as possible.
Oh, definitely. Though I have to say one of my favorite stories from this book is the story of the bell pepper, which nobody's really clear who named this sweet green pepper, the bell pepper. But apparently when it first appeared in print in the 1680s, and it was through this guy named Lionel Wafer, who was a pirate. Actually, he was a ship surgeon, and he transferred allegiances, joined a pirate ship, ended up with William Dampier, who was a pirate and botanist. I mean, how is that for a job, pirate and botanist?
Well, you'd probably be able to collect samples pretty easily.
And was wounded in a gunpowder explosion, and badly enough so that his shipmates dropped him off in Panama. And so he stayed in Panama for a year with a local Indian tribe, healed up, and when they came back to pick him up again, they didn't recognize him. He had a nose ring and face paint and was wearing a breech clout. But they collected him, and he ended up in Virginia, where he wrote a book on his experiences in Panama, and he mentioned the bell pepper and called it the bell pepper. He was also promptly arrested in Virginia for being a pirate, and he got off, but he ended up paying a huge fine, part of which went to found William and Mary. So any of you who are out there graduates of William and Mary, you know, this was all pirate loot.
Wow. That makes it all that much more attractive as a school, I would say.
Doesn't it? Yes.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to get to David and Madison. But first, we talked briefly about asparagus, and there's a lot of history and mythology around asparagus. It was considered pretty powerful sexually, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Anything that was even vaguely penile-shaped was considered an aphrodisiac. And asparagus was much favored by Madame Pompadour, who was the mistress of Louis XV. And she invented a number of asparagus recipes, including some that are still around.
And Louis,
the king.
Louis was really quite the gardener, or the wanting to have gardens, and so having lots of gardeners out there doing the work for him.
Well, the one that was really known for that was his grandfather, who would have been Louis XIV, who established a massive kitchen garden at the Palace of Versailles, where he grew everything under the sun, including thousands and thousands of asparagus plants. Mm.
Well, let's go to David in Madison next. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I have never called in before. I'm really glad you're accepting my call. I've got two comments. I'll be very concise because you're closing in on the end. So the first one is about a starch. Triticale, wheat. In France, during the 19th century, had that ergot problem. And then the other comment I'd have would be about a capsaicin, a pepper grown in India, and we got it out of our garden this year. It's called a ghost pepper. It's the hottest thing I've ever had in my life. It's a million Scoville units. Like a habanero is about 200,000.
Okay, David, I'm going to ask Rebecca to comment on that because I know she wrote about the ghost pepper.
I have never tried a ghost pepper, so I'm fascinated to hear from somebody who tried one and survived. It is so hot that it has been proposed as a counter for marauding elephants, as an anti-terrorist weapon. I mean, this thing is just monstrous. So I'm fascinated with it. I know you can get seeds. I'm thinking about trying it next year, though I have to say Vermont is pretty chilly, and our peppers don't tend to heat up as much as they do in hotter climates.
And also, just in the last minute or so, we talked about Louis XIV being a great proponent of gardening and having a variety of different vegetables. Thomas Jefferson, on this side of the ocean, was a real proponent of trying different types of vegetables and seeing what would grow.
Oh, he was incredible. His kitchen garden was massive. He grew dozens of varieties of everything he could find. Interestingly, was quite a vegetable man. He had a rule that lettuce had to be planted at Monticello every Monday morning, so that he would always have lettuce every subsequent week throughout the growing season for his salads. And he started what was called the Charlottesville Pea Contest, where he'd organized all his neighbors to compete for who would have the earliest crop of peas. And he never won.
But he was good-natured about it.
But he was good-natured about it, yes.
Well, Rebecca, we have barely scratched the surface of your fascinating book, but unfortunately we are out of time. The book is How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Curious but True Stories of Common Vegetables, and I would certainly recommend reading it. It really is very entertaining, and like I said, Rebecca, it's clear that you had a really good time writing it.
Oh, I did. Thank you so much for giving me the chance to talk about it.
Thank you so much. Rebecca Roop is the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, Fascinating but True Stories of Common Vegetables. We are going to talk about knitting now. There is a Wisconsin resident that many people are familiar with, but probably a lot are not. Elizabeth Zimmerman really revolutionized American knitting, and we are going to find out how in just a moment.